Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am here with Martin Techno Willis.
Wow.
I like that.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
You know why? Because you're like a techno, more than you know, you're like a techno genius. Because you were awesome at our conference. You were running the TriCaster, the most complicated piece of machinery we have. Does all the switching. And what people don't know is, like, when we're projecting out to the screens, you know, that's what people see who are there. At the meantime, the person working on the TriCaster, our switcher, is also switching what is seen on the DVD. So you got to be doing both at the same time. And then you were doing it during some of our most important times. So you did it during the Elizondo piece and then also during the award ceremony. And I know you were scared because during the award ceremony, it's important because you can't accidentally show people, you know, what's coming up, which happens sometimes because you want that to be a surprise. So there was one little mistake during the award ceremony. I guess people don't even have to know it. It wasn't, you know, we can edit that out. That's what's fun about this stuff. But that wasn't your fault. The audio guy forgot to turn off the music at one point.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to start one of the videos over. But great job, buddy.
Well, you know, it was really the crew you have behind the scenes. People don't know this, but they're just great guys. Every one of them. I just really, really enjoyed hanging out with them. And they were, you know, they taught me how to do that stuff. And boy, it is complicated. I was nervous, but I thought it all went off pretty good.
It went awesome. So, you know, a shout out to some of those people behind the scenes who are just awesome. You're right. Our help is amazing. I mean, they want to keep doing things all day long. It's hard to get them off of their position. So all day long, they're running these things. So we had, we had Jordan Pease. He does the duplication. You see him at a lot of these conferences backstage, along with Carlo Petrick, who's backstage with Jordan doing a lot of these. So like at MUFON, I think they have Paula backstage, stuff like that. Carlo's kind of our director, oversees everything, makes sure everything's running on time, helping you with the TriCaster. On the TriCaster, we had Danny Torgerson, kind of a local hero out here. He's a musician and just funny, goofy, cool guy. Yeah. Yeah. He has shiny pants and he likes to help me give away door prizes when he's present. And then you were running TriCaster with him. We had Dennis Fryermuth, who is actually the local chief MUFON investigator. And he's awesome. He was helping with making the DVDs and stuff. He has his own AV company. Right. And then we had Al and Don running cameras. Don Robb, good buddy, local guy. We see often. He's a retired fireman for Mesa. And Al was a friend of Danny's. I guess he's kind of Danny's manager. And he came and he ran the cameras the whole time, even when Danny couldn't make it. He was awesome. On the audio, we have Michael Beaulieu, I think is how you say it. He's a genius. He's amazing. He's back there running all the audio. He helps set up the lights, but he's back. If something breaks, he rewires it and gets it working again. Incredible stuff. We also had Heidi Gadd. She was helping out. She owns a music store nearby. We met through Danny, but also she runs a radio show locally or works on one. So she was helping out backstage. Front of stage, we had My family actually showed up. My sister Liza was helping selling stuff.
They were great.
My stepdad Jewel, my sister Carrie helped. She was here with at least packing and unpacking stuff. And then we had Chase Kletsky helping sell stuff. So, of course, she's a well-known ufologist in her own right. She's awesome. Victoria Albright was helping out. And they're awesome just because they're both people who smile all of the time. And
she was funny.
Yeah, really funny. So that helps. And then we had Marianne Robb, who's Don's wife, helping with the vendors and various other things. She's a Gilbert police officer. But another person who's just absolutely awesome. And I think that is everybody.
Yes, I have to say something about, is it Michael, the sound guy?
Yeah.
What a character. Oh my God, is he funny.
He's a unique individual. He, if people go look at Bryce Zabel's Facebook, he helped Bryce find a scorpion in his room. And Bryce had a scorpion one night, and I told him, you ought to talk to Ben. He might have some equipment. And Michael heard. He's like, oh, let me help. So Ben and Hansen and Michael went up there, and they were able to help him out. Hilarious. But, yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. I should talk about my guest before we move on. The guest today is Luis Elizondo. Not live. Yay. Not live, though. However, it's the interview that we did, that we showed at the UFO Congress. And the reason I'm playing it today, some of you may have seen it because I just did post it, or many might not be aware. I just posted it on YouTube late last night. So it's been up, and by last night, I mean Saturday, because we're Martin's going to be busy tomorrow on Monday when we usually record. And so we're recording on Sunday here. So it'll be up a couple days by the time you all hear this. But I know my listeners are podcasters, so you guys don't get to get on your computer and go look at YouTube and everything so much. So, and I know you guys typically appreciate when I do this, when I take some of our videos and I put it in audio format so that I can play it on the show. So this is all for you, so you all can hear from Elizondo yourselves, and then I'll follow up the last 10 minutes with some thoughts and some things that he shared with me specifically, because I have spoken to him prior and after hit the interview, and so that should be exciting. And this being Sunday, some of you may or may not know, tonight, Sunday night, he's going to be on with George Knapp. Which reminds me, I got to respond to an email because George Knapp was really excited that I was able to get that video up because he wanted to look at it before the interview, his interview. And then he asked me some questions about, you know, what can he follow up on? And there are some things he could follow up on. So, yeah, so some of the questions that George will be asking will be generated from these questions that you're going to hear now, too. And most likely he'll be referring to our interview. So George Knapp's awesome. Of course, a big hero.
Yes, actually wrote him, and he responded to me. I wrote him a question to ask tonight that someone keeps asking me to ask. And anyway, he said he's gotten over 300 emails, tweets, and texts, and he says he'll do what he can.
Yeah, I hear ya.
He says he needs 4 2-hour interviews to be able to cover everything people have been asking him to ask. But this particular audio you're going to be playing here, it is the questions that were asked are actually from some of your listeners.
Yeah, mostly they're from listeners. There's some from researchers, some are mine, but mostly they're from listeners. And there was also a Reddit that was somebody posted, one of the listeners posted. And he got some questions there and forwarded to me, so some are from there as well.
And they're absolutely great questions. Some that I have thought that just in my own mind that I would like to know. And I know we can't really do any spoilers here, but you know, just some of the things he said in that interview, I mean, really are quite amazing.
And yeah, there are great questions, and he was very open to answering any and all questions, and that was really cool. He's like, bring it on. I don't care how crazy they are. I don't care if these guys are skeptical and think I'm some kind of faker or something, and he just addressed that in the questions.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, who are they? They don't have to believe me. He's really, really cool about it. So having watched that, I'm curious, what was your impression? What did it change your mind at all? Or was there, I guess, yeah, did your thoughts about the whole thing or him change at all?
You know, I kind of had a feeling about him in the beginning that he was just like a down-to-earth guy. And this video now, audio, really proves that very well. You know, just for a couple of his responses to the questions were like, well, if you know, kind of like be skeptical. You should be skeptical and be skeptical of me and everyone else. And, you know, let the data speak for, you know, what's going on. And he was very encouraging. And I'm encouraged because I think that there is a lot more to come. And mm-hmm. I'm really excited to, and I feel like he's on our team. I don't know
yeah.
if you feel like that, but I feel like he's on our team and he's a really good person to be on the team.
You know, I've been telling people that because I'm talking to him and he wants to be on the team and he's excited to be on the team. And people keep making this kind of an us versus him type of thing. And I'm like, guys, no. He is on our side. I mean, he's a team member, kind of like Nick Pope is now, you know, someone who worked in the government and is now doing what we do. And I think you get that sense. You know, I think with genuine people who are just trying to speak from the heart and not lie, but just try to, you know, articulate information as best they can and answer questions as truthfully and as thoroughly as possible, they come across as genuine. I would say you're one of those people, you know, as far as, you know, people who people are always wondering, are they lying? Are they not? But Travis Walton is one of those people. And mm-hmm. it's important to meet people like that to get a sense of them. And I think very quickly you can get the sense of someone, and at least someone who's open and honest. And that's the sense I get from Lou. You know, we did that whole presentation where I introduced the whole thing and got people up to speed for a while. And then Nick and I did a wrap up at the end. And I told mm-hmm. people this, that if he's lying, he's fooled me. And because he just comes across as a very, very genuine person.
And one of the things he says, and people do have to keep this in mind, is, you know, he probably still has his high level, you know, clearance. Mm-hmm. What am I trying to say? But he can't divulge a lot of things. I mean, there are some things that he just are still top secret, that he knows that he absolutely cannot talk about. And I think that's where some people get frustrated.
Well, just like Nick Pope is the same. There are times where Nick Pope says, I can't answer that question. You know, in particular, I remember he won't talk about like the Queen and whether he's briefed her or the royal family and their interests, because that's a topic I love to write about. And of course, we've got a lot on that at openminds.tv. But yeah, he's like that, but so is like so are others like John Alexander. And of course, these people get mm-hmm. accused of being liars, like disinformationists working for the government, which is kind of sad. Just because you worked in the military or worked in defense, you know, you're a liar. You can't have an interest in this stuff. I think my listeners are not the type that go down that road so much, but Lou himself even says, you know, you'll hear him talks about, you know, the importance of being skeptical.
You know, he knows a lot, like I just said, he knows a lot that he can't talk about. But what he does say is, I know UFOs are real, you know, right. And just coming from someone that had a government position that is researching UFOs, basically, for that, I mean, that's kind of monumental in a way.
It is. It really is. You're right. I mean, just that he says that there is a program and the program continues is monumental. Really important, really amazing stuff.
And, you know, a lot of people think, you know, the program stopped in 2012. I think that's when they say it was. But it actually continues. It's just a different type of funding.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, people just know about the funding, the $22 million for the 5 years. They're, you know, the government's always been very, I'll say crafty at funding certain projects.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's funny. In this interview, you'll hear Lou Elizondo speaking about that. But that is also one of the things. If you go to the video, remember, you know, I encourage people, please do go to our video on demand. You know, we don't charge for people to listen to our podcast or much, but we do charge a slight monthly fee to go to our UFO Congress video on demand. And you can see literally hundreds of videos there. And I do have up right now the Lou Elizondo video, so you could see my introduction and Nick Pope and I discussing afterwards. But Nick Pope talks to that point. How can you run a program with no money? And Lou talks about it, I think, very clearly, and then Nick Pope backs him up, and exactly, this is how we did things. And so you hear more about that coming up.
Yeah, yeah. It's too bad he couldn't make it. He really wanted to be there. Mm-hmm. It's just the scheduling issues. It's too bad, but I thought the video was very well done, and it was, you know, it didn't feel like anything that was edited. It just felt like he was just talking, which was really good.
Yeah, just answering the questions as best he could.
Yeah. Well, I also really enjoyed at the Congress, I really enjoyed the Travis Walton segment.
Oh, that was great.
And so many more, but I mean, that was really special.
Exactly. It really was. I agree with you. I mean, to have the police officer who was on scene, and what was great is him and Travis's brother were so good. I mean, when they came mm-hmm. on, they talked about their experience and their side of things each. And they were so mm-hmm. thorough in the way that they did it, and they had funny stories, emotional stories. They were absolutely incredible. That was a great presentation. I loved them.
I have to say that was my favorite.
Really? Yeah, that was really good.
Luis Elizondo was amazing, but that was definitely my favorite of the time.
That's
but
good.
There were so many other great speakers. I mean,
you know what was fun? Thing on the Travis thing. What was really fun too, and it was really off the cuff, was Karen, because you know, mm-hmm. my listeners heard Karen talk about how she discovered, you know, the police officer Chuck Ellison, and what, you know, those people had to say, but which was really cool stuff. So the listeners already had insight on that. But during the talk, you know, I was thinking, oh, Karen really needs to share this. So I was tweeting her and trying to get her in the room. So I did get her in the room. And then when we opened up the questions and answers, we're able to get her on the mic. And then she actually read the email from Gillespie, the sheriff. And mm-hmm. and that was really cool. And as she revealed on the show, you know, a few weeks ago, the sheriff shared with her, at least his wife, that he believed Walton and the guys. He believed that they were not lying, that they experienced something, which is essentially what Chuck Ellison said. So this is straight from their mouths. So, you know, all of those skeptics out there who are making up all of these different scenarios of Travis lying and saying that the sheriff had busted him, that was, at least from what we were told, not true. From what they conveyed to Karen just before he passed away, you know.
He believed
this stuff.
That was who played, James Gardner played his.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, in Fire in the Sky. I had a dinner at one of the dinners, had a conversation with Chuck Ellison, and, you know, just chatting. And he said, you know, we had to think that Travis was buried in one of the brush piles they were going to burn. We had to think, he said, it's not what I wanted to think, but he says, as a police officer, I had to be responsible and think that way, you know, when this crazy story, you know, came out. He says, you know, the first thing he noticed is that they were all like stomping around and crying. You know, a lot of them were crying, and they were really a wreck.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it was really, really an amazing, that was really good.
Mm-hmm. You were going to say something else. I think you were going to move to another talk before I stopped you.
Well, I know Dean Aliotto, however you say that. Uh-huh. He was such a character. What a funny guy he was. He was really good.
Yeah, he was great.
And what was some of your other favorite? I know, unfortunately, I missed Bryce. Zabel's talk, but
Bryce was great.
I've heard a lot of people talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of other great talks. I would say Stephen Bassett and Linda Howe and Bill Burns, who were some of our headliners, were fun. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say fun is that and interesting, but they do a lot of connecting the dots. That means making assumptions and speculating. That's what makes that interesting. But I really love the hard stuff, like what Elizondo was sharing or the Walton stuff, too. Michael Carter was a lot of fun because he's just a neat guy and an inspirational guy. And this is one what was interesting because he didn't have a lot of necessarily content UFO-wise, but he still did really well. And he was one of the most popular talks just because, my listeners will know because I have him on the show for the same reason. He's just so inspirational and it makes you feel good. But all of these people did a great job. I mean, they were flawless in their presentations. Bassett's going to be doing a documentary. He's real excited about Rockefeller. So people should go to his site if you want to help him out with that. But people really loved Susie Hansen. She got probably the biggest applause.
Standing ovation.
Yeah, and there were a couple other standing ovations, but sometimes the speakers will kind of wait for it and then people stand up and that happens. But she wasn't even really soliciting it or expecting it. And just as soon as she was done, people were on their feet. And that was really interesting because she's, of course, an abduction researcher with her ideas about how all of this contact stuff has happened. So that was really nice to see. Of course, we brought her all the way from New Zealand. So, and it was a local MUFON, Stacy Wright especially, and some of the other local MUFON people who had said she was amazing, and people did love her. So, I don't know. There were a lot of really – I think they were all good. I personally did not feel that there were any duds.
I agree.
Sometimes there are, but I didn't feel that way this year.
Alice Druffel, what a classy woman she was. Talking about her mother, Anne Druffel, and James McDonald.
Yeah, that was great because, having grown up with this stuff with her mother, that was a lot of fun. And we gave her mother the Lifetime Achievement Award. Nobody knows this, I guess, outside the conference really yet, because we haven't posted much, and maybe she did, but Cheryl Costa also did a great job, and she was awarded the Researcher of the Year Award. I think the listeners would know why, because I referred to her and what she's done quite a bit, but we'll have our videos on these awards up soon as well, so you can hear the justification. And I think that people understood why she received the award. I think each of them, once they saw the videos.
Yes. And someone was asking me just today where they can actually buy these DVDs. They're on which website are they on?
UFOCongress.com. So UFOCongress.com is where you can buy the videos soon. We don't have them up there yet, but we will in the next couple of days. And then our new UFO Congress, I ask everybody, please go subscribe to our new UFO Congress YouTube, because we created a new one. That's where you'll find the Elizondo video. But we'll also be posting all of this stuff, these clips, on that YouTube site. So if you subscribe, you'll be notified immediately when we upload those.
Excellent. Okay, so that's where you posted the new I did see that video posted today, the Elizondo one, and that's going to get a lot of views for sure.
Yeah, it already has, but it looks like we're out of time.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, thank you all so much for helping. You were awesome, Martin, at the conference. You really did do a great job. Of course, everybody check Martin out at Podcast UFO. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back with the Elizondo interview. If you're listening to KGRA, you'll hear some commercials. If you're listening to podcasts, there'll be a short musical interlude, and we'll return shortly. Thank you very much, Martin.
You're very welcome, and talk to you next week.
We have a special treat for everybody today, and that is this exclusive interview we've got with Luis Elizondo that he did for the International UFO Congress. How this really came about is that I was luckily available to get a hold of Luis. He said that he was enthusiastic and excited about coming to the Congress and doing a talk and meeting people and answering all the questions he could. But then he had this medical procedure to do that got rescheduled, so he couldn't make it. Then he said, okay, well, you know, Karen and I could fly out there and interview him. But that didn't work out. So luckily, he was going to be in California visiting Tom DeLonge and some of the other Two of the Stars people. And so they said, you know, we'll do the interview. Send us questions from your listeners, and we'll do our best to answer those questions. We'll edit that together and get that to you by the Congress. And they did. And so it turned out excellent. He answered a bunch of really great questions. So some of these might be yours. So very excited about this. Of course, we have the video up on YouTube. But for you podcast listeners, I know some of you don't have a lot of time. And so you can't go to YouTube to watch the whole thing. So I thought you would enjoy to hear it here on the podcast. It's always kind of a fun way to get this information. We are going to do a follow-up interview in a month or so. And I'm sure we'll have Elizondo live on this podcast in the not-too-distant future, which is going to be really exciting. But you know what? There's so much to unpack with all of this information that it's not that bad, really, to get this information in bits so we can understand it. We can come up with better questions when we do the interviews. It was also a lot of fun at the conference. Now, you can go to our video on demand. Go to UFOCongress.com. You'll see a big advertisement and a link to the video on demand, and you can watch the entire Elizondo presentation because I went over how this all came about, you know, how we gave Tom DeLonge, you know, that award last year, and then how in October they released the To the Stars group, which we've referred to as the TTSA, and then how, you know, as a part of that, you all heard me talk with Leslie Kane about, you know, how important that news was, but it didn't seem like people were paying attention. And then you heard my follow-up interview with Leslie Kane just recently about the New York Times article that broke in December that just made huge news about this ATIP program. That's what we're calling it, because the acronym is the Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program, which is essentially looking for UFOs. And Elizondo confirmed that, the Department of Defense to confirm that this group exists, that, you know, they worked with Robert Bigelow to investigate UFOs. A couple of cases, of course, have been released. We've talked about a lot of this. So we asked Lou some of the important questions. Now, what they did is someone off screen read the questions to him and he answered them, but they edited out the questions and they put these slates in there so you could read the question. But of course, on audio, that doesn't work. So what we've done here is I have edited. I've said, asked the questions, and I'm editing in here the questions so you can hear them, and then you'll hear Elizondo's response. So that's how this is set up. Also, the beginning, he actually had a statement he said at the end that he made for the people at the conference. But when they edited the video together, they actually took that statement and put it at the beginning. So what you're going to hear first is Lou making this statement and then getting into the questions. Let's see, any other things you need to know? Oh, yeah, this is cool info, and this will be kind of exclusive for you, really, is that at that presentation at the UFO Congress that I talked about where I went over everything up until and then we played the Elizondo interview. I also did a follow-up. After we played the interview, we had Nick Pope on stage. And, of course, that's important because, really, as I feel, is Elizondo's kind of our Nick Pope of the U.S. Nick Pope, of course, worked for the Ministry of Defense in the U.K. investigating UFOs. And he had some really great insight that he shared after we watched the video. You can see that on the full presentation of the Elizondo video from the UFO Congress. So I do implore you, you know, it's only $5.99 to go register to the video on demand. And you got hundreds of videos. You've got this entire Elizondo presentation also. And we'll be releasing very quickly all the rest of the 2018 DVDs, including Martin's favorite, Travis Walton. We'll have that up hopefully in just the next couple days here. So really good stuff. Check out our video on demand. Without further ado, let's listen to this interview with Luis Elizondo.
Pursuit of the truth is the fundamental endeavor of mankind. The truth, whether it's for knowledge, enlightenment, or even love. The truth is the only thing that allows us to ensure our azimuth remains true and our destination assured. It is my experience that the success of any journey relies on the people who are along for the trip. As with every expedition, each person plays a critical role and serves a purpose on that trip. And yes, that includes healthy skepticism and even dissenting views and opinions. Only with all views and voices heard will we be able to plot a course that represents the best chance of our success for reaching far off shores. So, I say to you, here and now, let's not be afraid to ask the hard questions or challenge the words of our experts. Let's not be shy to own our passion and push the boundaries of our horizon. In conclusion, thank you for your courage and your time and your audience today. You are the true heroes and the ones who deserve awards. Thank you again.
How did you first get involved with ATIP?
My first involvement with the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program began back in 2008. The former program manager at the time was looking for somebody to provide dedicated counterintelligence support to the effort, which I wasn't aware of at the time. And so in 2008, a couple folks came to my office and they asked to have a conversation with me. And usually as a Fed in our line of work, when strange people come to your door and they want to talk to you, it's usually not a good thing. In this particular case, we had several meetings. They asked me a little bit about my background. And after the third meeting, I was introduced to the program manager. And at that point, it became apparent to me why they were asking me the questions they were asking me. And so in 2008, I was asked to come on board. I did, and I worked for the former program manager at the time. And in 2010, upon his departure, I was asked to take over the program formally as the director.
Did you work with Bigelow? If so, what was that like?
My personal experience with Mr. Bigelow has been nothing but unbelievable, a complete privilege and honor to work with such a titanic force in the aerospace industry. Mr. Bigelow is not only a commensurate professional, he is also a true gentleman. I found working with Mr. Bigelow's folks, all his folks, to be extremely rewarding. These individuals are truly some of the best of the best that we have, working in areas that that very few individuals have really any understanding of the complexity involved. You're talking about putting space vehicles in orbit around Earth and potentially around the moon. And so anytime you have an opportunity to work with individuals like that, it's always a privilege and an honor.
Where did ATIP receive its cases from?
ATIP received its cases from various different channels. So where our office sat at the top of the office of the Secretary of Defense, we had multiple avenues of approach. So you had, in some cases, reporting would come up through Navy channels. In other cases, it would come up through Air Force channels. In other cases, it come through the intelligence community. And as the single focal point, if you will, for this capability, all roads, I guess, lead to Rome in this particular case. All roads led to our office regarding the phenomena.
How did ATIP continue without funding after 2012?
So ATIP did continue. Continued in earnest after 2012, an additional tranche of funding was provided to our organization. Unfortunately, the congressional verbiage was a little bit vague, and so the funding was diverted to another office, but the funding was intended for us. So it was supposed to go from 2013 to 2014, and then at that point, fiscal constraints became increasingly tight within the department, and we were forced to do more with less, or in some cases, more with nothing. So we very quickly continued our efforts, and we started to dual use a lot of what we were doing. So as an example, one may be interested in putting out a requirement looking for, let's say, advanced ICBM technology, right? So you would go out and you would ask folks, I want you to be able to give me a paper that helps me understand anything coming into Earth's orbit with these particular profiles. So, you know, hypersonic velocities, low observability, et cetera. And what might be useful for, let's say, identifying North Korean ICBM missiles coming into continental United States could also be useful in identifying other objects, things that are coming in with that same flight pattern, but not necessarily a ballistic missile. So we got very clever at dual using, and the reporting continued to come in through our office. And quite frankly, the program never went away. So we just became very clever, as everybody else in the department, of having to manage our resources, I think, in an increasingly constrictive way that still allowed us to obtain the data we were trying to obtain, but in the same respect, not require additional resources to come in for new projects. So I guess in short, in lay terms, we got very clever at managing our money and our time and our resources. We learned to confederate a lot more. So rather than us shouldering the burden of everything, we learned to leverage our partners in the intelligence community and within the services to help us do a lot of the functions that we were trying to do in-house.
How were the videos released? Was it under false pretense or a trick, as the Washington Post suggests?
No, there was no trick, and there was no false pretense. The videos were released in accordance with the strict manner that DOD prescribes to DOD manuals and regulations involving the release of information. It went through the official DOPSR process, and then furthermore, an additional step was taken to have the videos reviewed by foreign disclosure representatives. In fact, the most senior foreign disclosure representatives in the department. And ultimately required OCA, or Original Classification Authority, approval and review to release the video. So in essence, I didn't release anything. The Department of Defense released those videos. The documentation is held by the Department of Defense. And the justification for releasing those videos were exactly as stated. And that was to create an unclassified database that people could then access and try to help us identify the signatures we were seeing.
Will we ever get more information about the gimbal video?
I suspect we will always get more information as people with additional expertise and experience and backgrounds continue to look at the videos, and not just gimbal, I think any and all videos, we will begin to put together more pieces of the puzzle. There are experts, I would submit now, that are out there, perhaps within this audience that is watching this video now, that have the ability to look at some of these videos and help us have a better understanding of what exactly we're looking at. I think it's important to understand that what people chalk up as atmospheric anomalies or FLIR phenomena resulting from infrared glare, I think it's important that the audience understand that we already have the equipment when we are, when this information is being collected, we can already ascertain very, very quickly whether or not this is infrared glare, heat glare, or an atmospheric disturbance. I think it's important to know that you can't get a radar lock on an atmospheric disturbance. I think it's important to recognize that we have already the technology that will tell us very, very quickly if something is simply FLIR fuzz or IR haze, if you will. So these things are certainly beyond our understanding at this point, but it is not, as some have stated, just some sort of atmospheric anomaly or reflection that we're seeing.
Why are the videos so short, and why do we not have more information about them?
So videos can be short for many reasons, just like audio or anything else. Keeping in mind there's a legal requirement to protect sources and methods within the U.S. government and classified information, and even some unclassified information that remains sensitive. So it is important to note that if someone is looking at a video, it is highly probable that the portion you're watching is what has been cleared for public dissemination and release. But there may be portions of audio immediately following that clip that gets into classified sources and methods. Perhaps it starts talking about the operating AOR at the time that the film was taken, or by precise capabilities and technologies that the U.S. government would understandably want to protect. So a lot of these videos and audios and things that people are seeing are short because of the fact that it's quite possible the government's protecting sources and methods, plain and simple.
How did you discover To the Stars Academy, and did it have anything to do with your decision to leave the Department of Defense?
My decision to leave the U.S. government was before I ever knew anything about To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. My initial plan was to frankly fade off into the sunset, take a job working something that I could enjoy that was completely unrelated to the U.S. government, and if you will, like I said, fade off into the sunset. It was actually the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science that found me. Through some colleagues of mine in the intelligence community, once they found out that I was leaving, had suggested that maybe I should talk to some of the folks at To the Stars who were interested in talking to me.
Do you think the story of the pilots and the aviation threat program has sunk in enough with the masses?
I can't answer on behalf of the masses. I sure hope so. Sad to say that I've been doing this for long enough where we have a lot of compelling information and data and documentation, eyewitness testimony, and there is still, for some reason, this hesitation, this blockage that prevents people from having an open and honest dialogue and conversation about the phenomena. And I think, from my perspective, that's actually more troubling than the phenomena itself.
How can I best bring up the UFO subject without being scoffed at? And what is the best way to get non-believers to take it seriously?
So, one short statement, the best way to not get scoffed at and ridiculed is not to have the conversation, sadly enough. That's the truth. However, cowardice will never get us where we need to go. So we have to have the conversation. I think the best way to have the conversation is having it where we allow the science and the data to speak for itself. Opinions, suppositions, things of that nature aren't overly helpful. In the end, it doesn't matter what me, Luis Elizondo, thinks. What matters is what the data says, and then you formulate your own opinion. And I think that is the strength. And when we're using the scientific method, it is imperative that we strictly adhere to those rules. Because ultimately, in the end, the data is going to speak for itself. And it doesn't really matter what I think. What matters is what you think based upon the data. So the easiest way to have the conversation, let the data speak for itself. Sometimes data, as you know, the truth, sometimes she whispers. And sometimes you have to really listen hard. But if you listen carefully, you can hear what she has to say. And that was my job for the last 10 years.
Were you previously subject to a non-disclosure order, and have you been released from it?
First of all, I was never released from any non-disclosure. agreement with between me and the U.S. government. In fact, I still maintain a security clearance, or at least I think I do. And so I'm obligated to protect classified information, at which point until the information becomes unclassified or I die. I have not been released from any non-disclosure agreement, and I am legally bound by those. And so that's why sometimes when I'm asked questions, what may come across as being vague or in general terms a bit evasive, it's not on purpose. The problem is I'm legally bound to protect that information. And so, in short, no, I haven't been relieved of that obligation at all.
Is it possible that the evidence and analysis for each case will be made available to scientists like us?
I think it's more than a possibility. I think it's an imperative. That conversation needs to occur between the American people and our lawmakers. And if the American people insist on it, then it'll happen. I think it's a matter of time. I'm not sure we can put, at this point, the cat back in the bag. I think the conversation has already been started. And I think it's inevitable. At least that's my hope.
What are your day-to-day activities and involvement at To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences?
Well, I was hired to be the director of security, global security and special programs. So right now, it's pretty simple. My job is to protect people, places, and things. So as any person in the security realm is aware of, it's a pretty basic function. I think it's very important, keeping in mind that this is not just a function where we're worried about traditional acts of crime, someone stealing something or something like that. There is potentially some counterintelligence perspective to this. There's personnel security. There's a whole spectrum of issues and things that we need to, we need to keep a handle on, especially if this company is going to grow, which hopefully it does. Those equities that the company have will have to continue to be protected.
What would you say to those who are skeptical because of your intelligence background and suspect that you are spreading disinformation and falsehoods mixed with some truth?
I would say remain skeptical. Healthy skepticism is very important. In fact, it's imperative. In fact, in my job as an intelligence officer, I was paid to be skeptical. I think you should always question all the information that comes before you by anybody who says anything. And I think that's true not just with people like me. I think it's true with government, religion, and everything in between. However, in this particular perspective, I don't really care if you believe me. That's not my intent. My intent is for you to listen to the data and look at the data yourself and allow you to come to that conclusion. In the end, it doesn't matter if you believe me or not. What matters is if you have access to the data, then you can formulate your own opinion. The one thing I've learned long ago as an intelligence officer is that you can be, I could be absolutely sure of something, absolutely certain of something, and I can still be absolutely wrong. So in the end, those of you who are healthy skeptics, remain skeptical. I think you need to ask the hard questions, continue to push the boundaries, because that's how we find the truth. The truth has nothing to fear. So if you don't believe something, then keep asking the question, keep doing the research, keep demanding the data. And hopefully you then can come to the same conclusion that some of us came to.
Pretty good stuff, ain't it? So we'll be right back with Lou Elizondo. We've got some more stuff to talk about. And then once the interview is over, there were a couple questions that I felt were really important that didn't get in the interview. So afterwards, when I talked to him about the video and how what we got, I said, hey, there were a couple questions, you know, one from Nick Pope and one from me that didn't get in there that I think are really, really important. And I wasn't sure if he would be able to answer them, but I did ask those questions and he was able to answer them. And I think that's some important stuff. So that'll be coming up in just a minute after this break and after the interview here. But it is time to take a break. If you're listening to KGRA, you'll hear a short break, some commercials. And if you're listening to the podcast, you'll hear a short musical interlude. And we'll be back momentarily. are back. You're listening to Open Mind UFO Radio. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas, and we are listening to a pre-recorded interview exclusive for the UFO Congress of Luis Elizondo. So let's get back into it. Why do you think these crafts are likely extraterrestrial and not from another country that has discovered more advanced physics?
So let's look at the term extraterrestrial. I don't like to use that term very much, but in a definitive way, when you look at the definition of extraterrestrial, it just means beyond terra firma, beyond terrestrial, beyond this thing that we call Earth. The question is, do they come from outer space, inner space, or the space in between? I don't know. I have my own personal opinions about it, but it would be very misleading to give you those opinions, because in the end, we don't have enough data. It would be great if we could point our finger and say, ah, it was the Russians or the Chinese or someone else. Problem is that the data that we're seeing, we've been seeing for a while, and it's so advanced that by now, it is hard enough for us now to replicate our observations with our understanding of quantum mechanics. But for this type of technology to be available when we first started seeing it, I think is beyond improbable. I'm not going to say impossible, but it is really, really, really unlikely. So that leads then to the next question. Well, if it's not ours and it's not theirs, then whose is it? I don't know whose it is. That's why we're asking the hard questions. That's why we did what we did for the last 10 years and why we need to continue doing what we're doing, because we need to ask those questions. We don't know whose they belong to. We don't know who they are or what they are, but we know that they're real. So I would submit to you that because of that, we need to continue to explore. We need to continue asking the hard questions.
Why is the running time of the two released videos, Nimitz and Gimbel, so short? Was there additional footage captured?
It's important to know that the U.S. government has a responsibility to protect classified information and sensitive information, to include sources and methods, by law. So oftentimes when you see information before you, you are looking at a snapshot in time under a very particular set of circumstances. Keeping in mind the information that may have come before that or after that could be very classified. It could discuss things, for example, of who took the footage or under what circumstances. Were they in combat? Was it in peacetime? Was it an exercise? Things that would give away are what we call tactics, techniques, and procedures, TTP, in the Department of Defense and in the intelligence community. So to protect that information from getting in the wrong hands, what you are seeing is information that has been deemed by the department to be unclassified. And that way everybody can look at it. What comes before that or after that, I can't discuss that. I'm not at liberty to discuss that because frankly, that's the government's call to make that determination, not mine.
Regarding the Gimbel video, do you know anything about the chain of custody documentation?
The chain of custody documentation is the province of the Department of Defense. I think it is. If anybody wanted to see it, it would be up to the Department of Defense to release it. It is a DOD form. It is not classified. So but unfortunately, as a DOD form, you have to go through DOD to ask for a copy of it.
What are the possibilities of additional releases of information from these incidents? Are you still working to release additional information? How can we help?
Now that I'm in the private sector, my intent is to push the envelope as hard and as fast as I can. I know what I've been privy to, and I think we need to have the information available so the American people can have the discussion amongst themselves and with our lawmakers, and then make a determination if it should be a national security imperative. That shouldn't be a decision that I make. That should be a decision that you make. And then you tell your leadership what you want them to do, and then your government does that.
Is there any reason to believe UAPs may be dangerous? Have there been any incidents where UAPs were aggressive or defensive in a way that could cause harm?
So, no outward aggression. But please allow me a moment to provide you a very a rudimentary analogy. I've used it before, but I think it's fitting. So, I think most people, not all, but most people would agree that locking your front door is probably a good idea to do before you go to bed at night. So most people do. And it's not that they expect something bad to happen, but we do it as a precaution. And so imagine every night now you lock your front door, you go ahead and you secure your windows, and you lock your windows, and then right before you go to bed, you go to your keypad, you punch in your keypad, and now your house, the alarm is armed, and everything is secure. But for some reason, every morning you wake up, you go downstairs to have your coffee, you look in your living room, and there's muddy boot prints in your living room, and they're not your boot prints. Now, nothing's been taken from your house, no one's been injured or harmed, and nothing is out of place. And yet, here you go every night, locking your front doors, you secure your windows and your alarm, you turn on your alarm, and yet still these muddy boot prints continue to show up day after day. So the question is, how do they get there? The question is it a threat? Well, I think you have to presume it could be a threat until you're sure it's not a threat. And that was my job when I was in the Department of Defense, was to make sure things were not a threat. And until I could prove they were not, I had to make the presumption that they could be.
Given the history of misinformation, disinformation, lies, concealment, omissions, and other cover-ups in the past regarding this subject, what gives you and your associates more credence compared to the past talking heads to give us faith?
Well, I think in the past we had just that. You had talking heads. You had people that had political motivations for one reason or another. Some of them had political allegiances. My organization, when I was in the Department of Defense, were apolitical. We didn't care if you were Democrat, Republican, Independent, or anything in between. Our job, our loyalty was to the American people. That's who we took an oath to defend. Keeping in mind, all of us, whether military or national security, took an oath to defend this country from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And that's exactly what we did. And to this point, even after I left government, I've never been officially relieved of that responsibility. So is this some massive effort for misinformation? If it is, it's probably the worst effort to do so because there would be holes all in it. I think for my motivation to come out, I gave everything to do this. I gave up a fantastic job. I was at the top of my career, doing very well financially, had a great 401k plan, great benefits, pension, everything. It's easy to sit back and armchair quarterback and on a weekend go through blogs and say this or that or this or that. Another thing is to give up every single thing you have going to pursue this in order to have the conversation with the American people. This, I can tell you, was not a financially good decision for me. It was not a good decision in anything, anyway, because I've spent my entire career living in the shadows. In fact, to some degree, my survival depended on it. Coming out in this way, if anybody were to ask me my opinion, I would say this is the last thing you'd ever want to do. But at the end of the day, I believe in what I'm doing. I believe it is the right thing to do. And if, albeit for nothing, for us to have the conversation, at least have the conversation now where we can do it, And you can hold your heads up high and not worried about the social stigma that's attached to this and the labels that have been given to you, then I think I've accomplished my mission.
What articles of evidence can you and your colleagues provide that you are willing to submit for independent scientific review?
Oh, my goodness. I think I'm going to have to leave that question to some of our smarter folks in the organization, some of our scientists, some of the folks like Steve Justice and Hal Puthoff and some of the folks out there who have probably forgotten more about physics than I'll ever know. As far as releasing that type of data and those type of theoretical arguments, that's not really my forte. And the problem is, if I tried to pretend to be that person, I would probably do a terrible job at it. So I'm going to leave that question to far smarter people than myself, and hopefully they can give you a better answer than I can.
You have said in interviews that ATIP has made significant progress in understanding the advanced physics of UAP. Are you going to share this knowledge freely?
Well, that's what we're trying to do. I think before you share any information, we first need to make sure, we need to ensure the veracity and the validity of the information is what it is. The last thing you ever want to do, and you would reinforce the whole misinformation campaign notion, if we put out information prematurely that has not met a rigorous standard of the way we look at information, then we would actually be doing a disservice to you and everybody else. When we were in ATIP, we applied the same level of rigor to these incidences, investigating these incidents, as we would to any other type of investigation, espionage or terrorism investigation. And I think you need to have that level of scrutiny when you're doing this type of thing, to make sure that the data is real and it's pure. Because what we don't want to do is get into a situation where we either inadvertently or on purpose mislead anybody. We have to make sure that we preserve the integrity of the information to the very best of our ability. So sometimes it's not necessarily on the timeline we like, but our hope is to get it out there eventually in a way that is clear, makes sense, and preserves, again, the data in a way that anybody could look at, if this was a court of law, and say, yes, that information has been preserved according to the way it should be preserved.
What are two or three books on the subject that you think most accurately represent the phenomenon as you currently understand it?
Wow. So people are going to hate me for answering this way. I have deliberately for the last 10 years not read any books, any blogs, any movies, anything related to UFOs. I've done that on purpose, not because I don't like anything about it. It's because as I understand it from a scientific perspective and as an investigator, I want to, if you will, sequester the jury. I want to preserve the information the best I can. And if that means ensuring I don't have any type of subconscious thought about something because I may have read an article where now all of a sudden, subconsciously, there's this idea or notion in my head that will then cloud my judgment of looking at the data that I'm looking at. So in order to prevent myself, protect myself from even being tempted to have some sort of conclusion before I have the data, I have purposely steered away from reading books. And it's not that they're not good books and they're not worth reading. I am absolutely certain they are. And now that I'm out, I plan to do so. But it was critically important for me to make sure I remain as unbiased and objective as possible while collecting and processing this data with my colleagues. And so for that reason, I avoided as much as possible trying to read anything that could somehow bias my approach.
You say not from any nation, but have not used the word alien. Why?
Well, because I think alien means a lot of things to a lot of different people. You know, we're here in San Diego, and right now people are trying to build a wall to keep out aliens. So, you know, I hesitate to use aliens because what does that mean? Alien just simply means something not from here. So by definition, you know, there's a lot of aliens that we have. I prefer to keep it without labels for that exact reason, because I think we prejudice. If we say aliens, we immediately assume outer space or out there. And when we could be talking about inner space, or as I said before, the space in between, the bottom line is we just don't know. And by putting a label on something, I think we prematurely prejudice the jury and our objectivity when we're talking about this subject. So that is why I haven't used the term aliens, because I'm not sure that's even accurate, because we truly don't know what's behind the wheel, or at least I don't. And so for that reason, I'm not going to speculate.
There have been claims that the audio of the gimbal video does not seem to be original. Professional pilots on duty would not use language like dude and bro. Also, the sentence, the wind's 100 knots out of the west, would not be pilot jargon. What would you say in response to such claims?
I would say these videos have been pulled off of U.S. government systems, and they are absolutely indeed from pilots on U.S. military platforms and capabilities. I will tell you, in stressful situations, whether it's a combat situation or not, sometimes radio discipline goes out the window. I've been guilty of it myself. Stress does things to individuals. It does different things. I think if one were to ask Commander Fravor or any of his colleagues if they ever talk like that, they'd probably tell you yes. I'm not going to answer on their behalf, but they will absolutely talk like that. And that's just, unfortunately, the way sometimes stress, we react to it as human beings.
Your background includes microbiology, immunology, and parasitology, with research experience in tropical diseases. Where did you study these subjects, and for what purpose?
So I attended the University of Miami. Probably spent less time studying than I should have. But I realized very quickly after nearing the end of my education there that I wanted to serve my country. And I wanted to serve my country in a way that I could use some of my education in microbiology, immunology, and parasitology in a productive way. So I joined the United States Army, and best decision of my life. Hardest decision of my life, but the best decision. And I quickly realized initially I wanted to go in and do some sort of biomedical intelligence, perhaps maybe dealing with WMD. But after I came into the Army, I realized that my true passion lied in the intelligence discipline writ large. It was less the medical side of it, and it was just intelligence. To me, intelligence was awful lot like playing a game of chess against an enemy you may never see. And so to me, that was very intriguing.
Can we expect more footage and or classified documents to be released anytime soon?
Well, classified information, no. I don't think we'll ever get classified information released. I think you can get classified information declassified, and once that information is declassified, then absolutely it can be released. But the government is usually not in the habit of releasing classified information. So if the expectation is for people that classified information is going to be revealed, I think they're going to be sadly disappointed. But on the good side of it, I think that there's plenty of opportunity to have information that may be sensitive or considered classified now, have that information stripped of sources and methods, and have it downgraded and declassified. And yes, I do. I think the intelligence community does this all the time. In fact, I know they do. And I think this is something that can be done in this area no differently than anything else. Look what just came out recently with the papers on the Kennedy assassination, et cetera. So it is possible, and I think it's certainly within the realm of reality. And if you ask me, I would certainly champion that effort myself.
What specific actions can regular people take to help the government release more UFO information to the public?
I think we need to engage our leaders. I think we need to engage those individuals who we put in office to represent us and our equities and our interests. And we need to let them know it's okay to have the conversation. It's okay to support things like Harry Reid and Senator Stevens and Inouye did, and have the courage to ask the hard questions and pursue doggedly the things that we don't understand. In fact, I think that is one of our sacred missions as mankind, is to pursue those deep, dark recesses that we have a hard time understanding and a hard time reaching. I think it's in our nature, I think it's in our spirit, and I think it's in our DNA. And so I would encourage everybody to reach out to their elected officials and keep asking the hard questions. Insist that the truth be made public.
Thank you so much to Lou for being on the show for us. Some really great information. Of course, this was exclusive for the International UFO Congress, but we wanted to share this portion of it with people because it's very important information at this time. To see the entire presentation and to see other presentations from this year and others, please go to our UFO On Demand that you can get to at ufocongress.com. Other information. So I told you, Lou and I had a conversation after this video was delivered to us, and I said, hey, there were a couple questions that weren't answered. Can you answer them? One was from Nick, and one was from me. He said, that would be great. Nick's question was, and I think this was a great question, especially given that he's someone from an insider himself, and I think that this answer would be telling, you know. But Nick wanted to know, what is your relationship like with your former colleagues? Lou's answer was that it's good that officially he has no relationship with them because, of course, he's retired. However, that personally he has a great relationship with all of the people that are still in the DOD that he used to work with. including the individuals who are running the ATIP program currently. So yes, it does continue to this day, and that's a big deal that right now the Department of Defense is investigating UFOs. Of course, for decades we were told that there was no interest by the government in the UFO topic, and not only did we find out that this program exists since 2007, but it continues to exist to this day. And Lou says that the person in charge is a very high-level official and that there are actually a team of people that are working on the ATIP program right now. So UFO cases are still being investigated. That's fascinating. So a great question from Nick. My question was regarding the medals, and now a little bit more has come out about this, at least on Coast to Coast. Last night, George Knapp had asked these questions, but if you haven't been able to listen to that, the question is about what about these alloys? The New York Times talked about these mysterious alloys that were recovered, that Bigelow's facilities even had to be modified to hold them. There was a little bit of clarification. Bigelow's facilities were modified to house a whole program, not just these materials. Like, there's a bunch of materials. But these are not alloys, he says. They are metamaterials. And what that means is, essentially, it's a manufactured material. And it has strange isotopic values that indicate that it's not from this planet. So this is material that seems to be manufactured, that seems to be very advanced, something that we couldn't create. And it seems to be have been created off-planet, essentially. So fascinating. That's all I was told. But now this answers the question to alloys, because people said, wait a second, there are no unknown alloys. That doesn't make sense. And so this clarifies that question. So really good stuff. We're going to be able to have some follow-up interviews coming up here in the not-too-distant future, so stay tuned. Unfortunately, I'm going to be, or actually fortunate for me, I'm going to be out of town next week, so there won't be a show again next week, because I got to relax. Oh my gosh, I'm barely recovered from the, I wouldn't even say I am recovered from the conference. In fact, I got an ulcer. Oh, so I'm relaxing and trying to take it easy. And of course, there's a lot to get done. Like I'll have up on the store in the next few days, also the DVDs. So you can go to the UFO Congress store and buy DVDs of this lecture as, or these lectures as well. So a lot of cool stuff going on, and I'll try to get some great stories because there's been some other cool stuff happening in the UFO world up at openminds.tv. But go to ufocongress.com, register for the UFO video on demand. It's worth it. Hundreds of videos, including this Elizondo video. So check it out. Otherwise, I want to thank Martin Willis for helping me out with the beginning of the show and helping us at the Congress. Like I said, he was awesome. Martin is amazing. And go visit him, of course, at Podcast UFO. I also want to thank Caleb Hanks for the open and closed music, Systematics for the bumper music. And I want to thank you, the listener, for listening once again. And for those of you who said hello at the conference, it's always wonderful to meet listeners. And I did get to meet a few more, and that's always an absolute pleasure. So you all have a great time. I'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Until then, adios muchachos.